And this weekend, while many Americans gather with friends to watch the Winter Olympics, Russians will do the same. Americans might favor beer and chips. In Sochi, it might likely be zakuski and vodka. Reporter Dina Pritchip explains the history and culture of Russia's traditional snacks.
Zakuski are often described as Russia's answer to tapas, a little bite to have with your drink. They can be as simple as salted herring or as rich as blini and caviar. Slava and Luba Frumkin grew up in Belarus, where having an assortment of zakuski on hand was a practical matter.
Nobody had phones. So people would come to you unexpectedly.
Suddenly opened the door and our cousins came. Come on to the table, it's not a problem. We always have something to everybody.
Having a little zakuski is a perfect way to welcome your guest in from the cold. And it's a perfect match for that first warming shot of vodka.
A Russian rule is that you never drink alone and you never drink without eating.
Anya von Bremsen is the author of Mastering the Art of Soviet Cooking. And she says that the dishes that make up the zakuski table, in a sense, tell the story of Russia.
First of all, it's pickles. Pickles is something very archaic, very Russian. You know, this is what sustained you through the winter.
The Soviet era brought new zakuski, some of them delicious.
You would have Georgian, Armenian flavors, chicken satsivi, chicken and walnut sauce. We had also beans with lots of spices.
And some of them not so delicious.
A lot of stuff with mayonnaise. It's an industrial product that the Soviet state was really pushing. And, you know, you'd have like 2-3 different salads under a thick blanket of mayonnaise.
And von Bremsen says that deciding which zakuski to serve shows who you are as a host, especially during Soviet times.
We had no housing to speak of. We had no cars to speak of. We all wore the same clothes. So the way you could actually show status, power, hospitality, you know, a whole host of emotions was through food, through making this lavish zakuski table.
Every single time, it's like, we're not going to fit all this on here.
That's Bonnie Morales, the daughter of Slava and Luba Frumkin. And she's got the Tetris-like task of trying to make everything fit on their zakuski table.
It's kind of embarrassing if there's tablecloth visible.
There are pickled apples, Georgian eggplant rolls, and about a dozen other little dishes. But while the zakuski are delicious, they're almost just an excuse to fill your glass, which for Russians like Slava Frumkin is an excuse for toasting. Toasting family.
My sister Asha is visiting here, and this is the closest soul in the whole universe. So I'm drinking to this.
For toasting the act of toasting, Slava's son-in-law, Israel.
One of my favorite sayings is that the space between the first and the second shot should be very small. So here's to making the space small.
And toasting Kachka, the zakuski restaurant Israel and Bonnie are getting ready to open here in Portland, Oregon, which Slava Frumkin hopes will bring their family zakuski tradition to a whole new table.
It's the whole family history. It's my mama. I'm getting too sentimental to continue, so let's drink to your Kachka. Good luck.
And by the time the hot zakuski come out, so does the accordion. For NPR News, I'm Dina Pritchett.
A trip to the grocery store offers what appears to be an abundance of chicken choices. From patties to pot pie, tenders to Cornish hens, the selection can be almost overwhelming. But you can count on just one hand the number of food companies producing those choices. In his new book, The Meat Racket, author Christopher Leonard investigates the handful of companies that have taken control of the meat supply, focusing especially on Tyson Foods. Behind that household name was a man Leonard calls a genius, Don Tyson.
Don Tyson had the ability to see the world as it did not yet exist. And the most important thing he saw back in the 1960s was that chicken would soon replace beef or pork as the most popular meat in the United States.
The idea was not common wisdom at the time. Up until the 1940s, chicken was reserved for special occasions.
It was a specialty meat. It's what you would cook for a nice Sunday dinner. Back then, you would typically cook a whole bird. It was a luxury item. I mean, when people talked about having a chicken in every pot, that was sort of a marker for affluence. But that really changed in the 40s and 50s when these farmers in the South figured out how to raise chicken more efficiently.
Well, you refer to raising chickens, especially in the early days, as a casino.
Yeah, absolutely. The market was very volatile. When supply outstripped demand, even by a little bit, the price of chicken would just drop through the floor. And it was hard to gauge production exactly right.
Well, this has to do with the fact that with a cow, you're talking anywhere from many months to a couple of years. I mean, you can raise a chicken and get it ready to be slaughtered in 6 weeks.
That's right. You can almost respond to the market in real time with the chicken. And in the early days, that's exactly what the industry looked like, this boom and bust type cycle of people seeing good prices, ramping up production, creating an oversupply, and then prices would fall again.
So this is what the Tysons, John Tyson and son Don Tyson, figured out, that other companies copied or tried to copy, but that they helped start. This idea that you had to account for this volatile market in the chickens themselves by doing what?
Well, this company, Tyson Foods, started in John Tyson's living room in the 1930s in rural Springdale, Arkansas. This was a hard place. Don Tyson did not grow up rich. And one thing he focused on relentlessly was keeping down costs. Because what he learned was that the market would get good and everybody would jump in and companies would get fat and everybody made a lot of money. But inevitably, the market would crash again. And the companies that survived were the low-cost producers.
Okay, nice thought. I suppose everybody, in a way, thought that. What Don Tyson figured out to do was to buy up every stage of production, even including the eggs that created the chicks. They had the feed. They had the slaughterhouses. They had the delivery systems. But the one thing they chose not to own were the farms. Why exactly? Give us a little economics lesson here.
First of all, you have to have a lot of land to have an industrial chicken complex. I mean, farm is kind of a bad word for these meat factories, is really what they are. They're these giant automated warehouses that can hold maybe 25,000 or more chickens at a time. And Tyson Foods realized that it was kind of a rotten investment to build chicken farms. So Tyson developed a system over time that's really called contract farming. And here's how it works. A person in a small town will borrow hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars from the local bank. They'll build a giant industrial footprint of chicken houses, and then they sign a contract with Tyson Foods, which will deliver the chickens to their farm, deliver the feed to their farm, and the farmer grows the birds to Tyson's exacting specifications.
Well, you describe this system, which, by the way, is not exclusive to Tyson, as something close to modern-day sharecroppers.
That's exactly what it is, a high-tech form of sharecropping. And the farmers in this kind of contract system have almost zero autonomy over their operations. They can't control the quality of the chicks that arrive. They can't control the quality of the feed. When things go wrong, they depend on Tyson Foods to tell them what goes wrong. But you point to a critical outcome of this, which is that the farmers do not keep the majority of the income from their farms.
But how many other companies in the meat industry follow this example?
Just three firms produce almost half the chicken in the United States. Back in the 70s, you know, nearly 40 companies controlled that much of the market. So what that means is these companies act as regional monopolies. You can go to any chicken town and you'll find that a farmer will have a choice between one, maybe two chicken companies to sign a contract with if they're lucky. So that's one of the key reasons why the terms of these contracts have become less and less advantageous to farmers over time.
I mean, isn't the beauty of this system, though, that the chicken's cheaper? And that's a good thing for consumers.
No, it's not.
Okay.
Chicken is not cheaper today. Meat prices have been rising very fast since 2008.
But chicken, not as much as other kinds of meat, right? And also, wouldn't it have gotten more expensive if this industry wasn't so centralized?
Chicken is relatively cheap today. It's cheaper than it was many, many decades ago, even though it's at nominal record high prices right now. But you're right. The American food system is a technological marvel. I mean, it does an incredible job at giving us meat that is more or less safe at a predictable price that's relatively cheap to our incomes. But I can say, chicken would be cheaper today if this industry was not so consolidated. You've got these giant companies whose reach spans out across 22% of the entire market, so a single company can cut its production and keep prices higher than they would be. A highly consolidated and monopolistic industry is not good for consumers.
I wonder how difficult it is for any person to opt out of the system, to steer clear of buying and eating meat produced by these enormous meat companies.
I have concluded that the only way to truly opt out of the system is to become vegetarian. If you're eating meat today, unless you know the farmer and that's the only meat you eat, you're participating in this industrial system. All of the unlabeled meat that is served in our restaurants, cafeterias, hospitals, at the grocery store, it all comes from industrial companies. And so I think we need to take a hard look at the system that delivers most of our meat to giant cities 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Christopher Leonard is the author of the new book, The Meat Racket. We reached out to Tyson Foods before our interview, and you can find their written statement at npr.org.
If you're looking to make an impression on your Valentine, flowers and chocolate can certainly go a long way, though maybe that's a little predictable. What about certain foods that are said to stir up passion? I'm thinking of oysters. NPR's Allison Aubrey has this report on the links between oysters and love.
Oysters are big in the restaurant scene. Just ask fishmonger MJ Gimbar. He'll be serving up hundreds tonight at Black's restaurants in D.C.
All right, so we've got four different species of oysters. The first oyster you're going to look at is a Kumamoto.
As he wiggles his knife in and pops open the shell, he says this oyster is one of his favorites. It's small and sweet. It tastes almost like melon.
Oh, yeah. It's really good. I love it. The texture is kind of like a creamy, velvety. It's basically like a kiss from the ocean.
A kiss from the ocean. MJ says lots of diners who order oysters don't think of it as just a dish. They're after something more.
There's something primal about eating an oyster. It's kind of exotic. It's almost like a sexual experience.
Now, MJ is certainly not the first oyster lover to make this association. Culinary historian Kathleen Wall of the Plymouth Plantation in Massachusetts says when it comes to oysters and other shellfish, the romantic association goes back at least to the Greeks.
The very origins of oysters and shellfish are from Aphrodite and Eros, the Greek god and goddess of love, rise up out of the sea on shells, on the half shell, as it were. And so there's that classical connection.
Back then, people thought just being near oysters could help kindle desire. The belief was rooted in the doctrine of signatures. This is the idea that if you look at a food, its shape can tell you which part of your body it's good for.
So if you look at oysters, their resemblance would be woman's parts, in particular, lady bits. And if you stirred this up, it would create lust and then create babies.
So the Greeks thought of oysters as a kind of fertility treatment. It sounds crazy, but to this day, scientists are still trying to see if there's something there. They've looked at the zinc in oysters, which is linked to increased testosterone, and most recently have focused on the amino acids found in oysters. One researcher in Naples, Italy, Antimo Daniello, who I spoke to by Skype, told me he's convinced that there is a scientific basis for an aphrodisiac effect.
Yes, this is all right.
He points to a study that found high levels of one particular amino acid found in oysters improved the sperm count of rabbits.
Yes, I was surprised, but I expected that.
Now, the extent to which this could be true in humans begs a lot more investigation. Perhaps the amino acids are significant, but if this is the case, similar amino acids are found not just in oysters, but in all kinds of foods, from fish and seaweed to avocados and eggs. Are they all aphrodisiacs? Now, historian Kathleen Wall is skeptical. She says maybe scientists have not been focused on the right thing.
The part they're not identifying is perception, what people think about food makes that food have an effect on the body. It's the placebo effect.
She says, look at how the narratives connecting love and oysters have amplified over the centuries. Take, for instance, 17th century Dutch paintings. Scattered oyster shells are a common symbol of lust. And in colonial days, women who sold oysters, known as oyster wenches, were thought to be inviting something more than a simple transaction.
Oyster wenches were noted to be perhaps a little easy because they were so stirred up by their mere proximity of oysters.
Wow, what a reputation. Wall says whether it's love or lust, oysters carry their past with them.
Now, we haven't let go of that, and that makes it more powerful.
So if our belief systems are key to evoking an aphrodisiac effect, consider this. It has not always been the oyster in the romantic spotlight. At one point in history, an influential health expert recommended the turnip for its strong aphrodisiac powers.
Turnips. Yeah, turnips. Just like, oh my goodness, turnips are the Viagra of the 17th century.
So if oysters aren't in your Valentine's Day budget, well, there's one affordable alternative. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You know, athletes burn a tremendous number of calories in competition and training. And with the Olympics underway, we got to wondering just what they consume to recover from a workout and fortify themselves for upcoming events. So we've reached nutritionist Nana Meyer in Sochi. She teaches at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs, and she is the U.S. Olympic speed skating team's sport dietitian there at the Games. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
So do speed skaters have to have a different diet than, say, a distance skater or, for that matter, a ballet dancer?
Yeah, absolutely. And it depends on the energy requirement. For short track and figure skaters, too, they want to be light on the day of competition. They still need to be fueled, but they're certainly not fueling like a marathon runner or a cross-country skier, for that matter.
Is the difference in what they eat or the amount?
Mostly the amount, and carbohydrate is the key player here because we store carbohydrate in the muscle as glycogen, and that's really the limiting factor for prolonged exercise, such as cross-country skiing, you know, prolonged distances. Whereas carbohydrate in a short tracker can become limiting, especially if they advance. So the longer they skate, they have many, many heats going into semifinals and finals. And so they're utilizing that carbohydrate, that glycogen, as quick energy, and they need to replenish that fast. And so we do a lot of things during the competition to make sure that they don't run out and they don't hit the wall. It's really important.
There's so many gels and power drinks. What do you think of them as a generalization?
They are fast energy, so they have been made for exactly this purpose. And so we do use them, but every athlete is different.
To put you on the spot again, is Gatorade good for anything other than dumping on the coach who wins the Super Bowl?
Whether it's Gatorade or Powerade or whatever sport drink it is, it's carbohydrate, electrolytes, and water, and it has, you know, its performance effect. So they're important.
I've heard there's a miracle beverage called chocolate milk.
Yeah, they like it. Anything chocolate. Yeah. I can see that, you know, there's this craving for chocolate post-exercise particularly. I'm from Switzerland, so I always say to some degree, yes, to chocolate.
You've written in a blog that you're posting that you're not a fan of juicing.
Yeah, it is quite wasteful. And you start out with a lot of produce, pounds and pounds, and then you end up with two little cups of juice and the rest goes to waste. So I'm trying some things here and not letting some things go to waste and mixing them up with some interesting combinations with olive oil and salt, and so that we can utilize some of those scraps as well.
What do you feel about caffeine?
Do they use it as a performance-enhancing substance? For sure. Whether it's in form of coffee or caffeine in a gel, it has a central, a brain effect especially. But we always caution the athletes because they have to be aware that supplements in a pill form, that these things can be contaminated and lead to a positive doping test. So we educate a lot and we try to push food. We're nutritionists, and if you can get a performance-enhancing effect from food, we go that route, or a drink.
Associate Professor Nana Meyer speaking with us from Sochi. She's dietitian for the U.S. speed skating team. Well, good eating to you, Professor.
Thank you very much. Good eating to you, too.